and welcome to Worlds Apart. Over the last couple of weeks, the idea of engaging Russia on matters of common security once again resurfaced in Europe after being treated as an act of geopolitical blasphemy, if not treason, for several years. Is it yet another ploy to appease the sugar daddy in Washington? Or perhaps the European elites are finally stepping up to their own plate? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Tomas Malinen, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Helsinki. Professor Malinen, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Now, I know that previously you faced quite a bit of criticism in Finnish media because of your skepticism, if not concern over NATO expansion, and also for your occasional appearances in Russian media. I wonder, what do you make of this sudden change of wind on the part of some European leaders who seem to be a little bit more reasonable, a little bit more open to diplomacy with Russia, which just a couple of weeks ago seemed like a moral sin of the highest order?
What we have seen during the past, let's say, 5 to 6 years, is that there are these sudden shifts, regime changes even, in the mindset of European leaders of how to respond to certain threats. Russia has been the main threat. Now let's see whether US with its ambitions towards Greenland will become the next. But this fits to the general narrative and thinking of, you know, our small forecasting agency, that there are these kind of unforeseen forces that put in motion these changes in the thinking. And now it seems that we have reached another change, and it can bring something good, naturally, for Europe, and let's hope it does. But we don't, of course, know how permanent it is.
Of course, and I think you would agree with me that the current generation of EU leaders may seem very resolute in their rhetoric, but when it comes to action, especially independent and strategically driven action, they tend to be very feeble and sort of herd-oriented. So my next question to you is, do you think this shift that I mentioned before, is it a shift in narrative or is it already a shift in thinking, which eventually may lead to a shift in policy?
Well, generally in Europe, it goes like there's a first shift in the narrative, then in the thinking, and then in the action. We have seen this in the policies of the European Union for several decades already. So everything starts with these minor notions that something has changed, or we need to do this and we need to do that. So essentially, in the positive sense, this is a prelude to an actual change in policy and actions, which could come to head within the next few months. This is the positive thing. But the thing we have to remember about the current geopolitical situation, that it changes very rapidly, and there are so many players here, like China, Russia, and of course Washington or the US, who, and especially the actions of President of the United States, Donald Trump, are very like, irrational is probably the wrong word, but very like drastic and sudden. So they can bring about a major change also in this retrospect. But I am positive what comes to the current, or optimistic on what comes to the current change of tone in European leadership.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Trump's actions may seem erratic only if you do not follow the longer trends of American policy. And there is an opinion among geopolitical analysts that the war in Ukraine was acted on and sustained as a means of not only expanding NATO, but this whole thing about expanding NATO was a means to keeping the Americans invested heavily and being present with boots on the ground in Europe. Do you share this point of view? And if so, What would the hypothetical end to the Ukrainian conflict on its current realities, of course, mean for NATO and European security?
Well, funny as it is, just before this interview, I've been writing something I entitled The Grand Unified Theory of Geopolitics, which the first part, which will be published this week in the newsletter of our company, GNS Economics, goes through what has happened in around Ukraine. And the kind of the founding block of everything is that the current state we are in Europe starts from the fall of the Soviet Union, which was in actuality the fall of the control or model of controlling the world economy, not just world economy, but the world. And now that the Soviet Union fell, the kind of aspirations of the let's say the driving forces of U.S. foreign policy have come to in a very visible form, so to speak. So if we want to look what is happening in Europe and in the world, it's a reflection of the kind of hegemonical aspirations of the U.S. administration, which were before subdued by the Soviet Union or the other superpower. So now they are now visible, and actually they imply that the union or alliance, maybe it's better call it an alliance, which was forming between Europe, Russia, and China, basically since the fall of the Soviet Union, would have become a threat to the U.S. global hegemony, and it needed to go. And this is basically my thinking about the conflict in Ukraine, is that the U.S. needed the threat of this alliance to go, and Ukraine was the best way to do it. I know this sounds a bit conspirational, but a lot of political scientists in the 1990s warned against NATO, warned against U.S. to not to expand in the Ukraine and Georgia. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there was one camp in the United States and perhaps more broadly around the world and in Europe, the so-called globalist elites who pushed for that. But there was also another sort of strand of American strategical thinking that surfaced during the Obama administration, because I think it was the liberally minded President Obama who was the first to say that the Europeans need to increase their financing of NATO and that the United States needs to shift its focus away from Europe and onto Asia. And for that, it needs military and economic resources. And what was interesting for me is that it was during the Obama administration that this conflict in Ukraine started simmering on, but Obama did keep the lead on it. It was really during the Biden administration that the whole thing blew into a kinetic conflict. And my question to you now is, why do you think the political class in Europe chose to side with the Bidenites at that time, rather than trying to mediate this growing controversy, this growing conflict for their own benefit?
This is something, actually, I have to admit that I don't have a definite answer yet. But generally, we need to think these moves by the U.S. as something that all these major actions are basically done and calculated in Pentagon, in the Ministry of War. So in what comes to Europe, I think that somewhere along the 2010s or something, Pentagon calculated that the risk of a forming of a Eurasian alliance was too high and something needed to be done, and this job was given to the CIA or whatever. But this led to this current cycle. And how the European leaders fit into this is something I'm not really sure of. But if one wants to establish a kind of a conspiracy theory, is that there is some force behind them that basically ordered them to act like this. It can be the U.S. deep state. It can be the intelligence agencies or whatever. But the response Well, the uniformity of the response of European leader indicates that there is a let's say, supervising factor of faction behind them driving this.
Well, in your answer, you're sort of treating Europe as this docile victim that is receiving whatever comes from the United States. But just being a contrarian here, what if by aligning themselves with this war effort, and I think at this point of time, the Europeans are more hostile towards Russia and towards any peace prospect than anyone, certainly than the United States. What if the Europeans were actually trying to sort of be a tail that wags the dog? Don't you think that by supporting the war effort in Ukraine, they were actually trying to tie the Americans in and prevent them from going anywhere and pursuing their interests in Asia or somewhere else? Isn't it a little bit like a codependent marriage when, you know, you call the other partner an abuser only to make sure that he stays in and pays all your bills and you don't have to do anything?
To answer this, we need to ask that who is driving this? And we know that CIA, even Pentagon, sometimes act against the political leadership of the U.S. So we can speculate that maybe the U.S. deep state was something that kind of drew the European leaders into this conflict. And what it has become now is basically a tool of survival for the European Union. If we look at the economy of Europe, it's basically in a slow-moving state of collapse, which started from cutting the Russian gas and oil from Europe. So if the Russian threat would come to an end, everybody would start to look at what has the European Union actually done, and the conclusion would be that it's not doing anything good. So I think that whatever started the support of European leaders to the war in Ukraine or a threat against of a Russian threat, it has morphed into a survival method.
Well, if it were a survival method, it's supposed to be aimed at life. But from what we are seeing right now, it's aimed at death. It looks more like a suicidal rather than survival strategy. But for the time being, Professor Malinin, let's take a very short break. We will be back to this discussion in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
This is it, Moscow. And you know why I'm here? Because when somebody tells me that I cannot report something, it's my nature as a journalist to question why. Why can you tell Ukraine's side of the story, but you can't tell Russia's side of the story? That would be a half-truth. You know another way of saying half-truth? A lie. When Washington or London or whoever tells me I'm not allowed to tell the truth, you know what I do? The opposite. I shine a light on it. That is the Sanchez Effect. And I'm Rick Sanchez. Look for it.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Thomas Malinin, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Helsinki. Professor, just before the break, we were talking about the growing disagreements between the United States and the European Union. And just a few weeks ago, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said in an interview that the EU is stuck in the past, that its leadership keeps reminiscing about what has been, instead of looking ahead or trying to adjust to the changing realities. I wonder if you agree with that.
Yeah, actually, I haven't seen that interview, but I would ask Vice President Vance that where should we look? Because the good times of Europe are behind us now. And they were created by the cooperation with Russia and with China, with Russia providing the raw energy and China basically being our factory. And this created the Eurasian Alliance. And we, after the Soviet Union fell, we really tried for about two decades. And it is a great time for Europe. So I don't know where does he want us to look, where there is to look, because everything that was good is behind us, and what we see in front of us is not a like. It doesn't look like a good future for Europe.
Well, I'm not a spokeswoman for JD Vance, but I assume that he was talking about pretty generous and comfortable American assistance that was provided to Europe. But you are absolutely right that what has been in the past is also a rich history of cooperation, economic cooperation with Russia when it comes to Germany, France, Italy, and of course your own country, Finland. I wonder if there is any nostalgia for this aspect of the past, for, you know, the years when the Russians in large numbers went to Finland and Finnish businesses were operating across the border, and that produced a lot of economic benefits, as well as cultural exchanges, cultural influence, geopolitical influence between the two countries.
Well, there's actually quite a lot. Did you hear that we had actually the first demonstrations of opening the eastern border? I think it was in late November or early December. Did you hear from those?
Not really, but
okay. Well, the thing is that they were quelled rather quickly by the authorities, which was also rather strange. But there were a lot of people, businessmen, for example, who operate in the east, demanding that the border is open, because the fact that Russian tourists and Russian money left, it just collapsed the whole economy of eastern Finland. So there is this growing nostalgia towards our good relations. But the problem with the Finns is that we tend to think that we have been kind of in the geopolitical game for so long. So now many just think that it was good, but now we have to go with what we have. So that's kind of the, it's a martyrdom of Finnish populace, basically what is happening. But there is a lot of nostalgia for sure.
I certainly can sympathize with the sentiment of the protesters, because I think historically your country managed to navigate the Cold War antagonism and post-Cold War relationship with Russia in a very remarkable way. You are actually a standing out example there. You could have shared your expertise with Ukraine and many others, but instead, the current leadership of Finland decided to give up this privileged economic relationship with Russia in order to join NATO in 2023. How do you think the current leadership will be or would be able to justify this sudden reversal of policy if indeed some of the other EU members decide to turn around and engage again in a constructive relationship with Russia? Let's say Germany or France or even Poland decides to, you know, bury the hatchet. What would the current leadership do in this case?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of a Finnish political heritage, or the changing of the jacket, so to speak, is in the political heritage of Finland. That happens often. So I guess they would just slowly turn the tide and tell that we need to do this now, we need to open the dialogue, and many Finns would be happy for it and ask for the opening of the border and all those things. So I don't think that will create a lot of problems in Finland, but I of course don't know how the Russian leadership or Russians in general view that. Would they come back in large quantities? Maybe, I don't know. But I don't see a lot of problems with that, because we had, like, Finns and Russians, we had a very long prosperous relationship, even before, but especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. So many Finns still view Russians as friends, and I know many Russians view Finns as friends. So I don't think there is a big problem there.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a spokesman for President Putin, but I think that he may see a strategic value in what you just said, that, you know, despite Finland breaking all ties with Russia and joining NATO, you know, there could be a good case study between Russia and Finland to show how this relationship could be rebuilt. And if there is a political will on both sides, I think it could be done fairly easily. Now, the question to me is, do you think the people in Finland, not the political class, but do you think there would be a popular support for that? Because it's one thing to reverse your security policy on the spur of the moment, which happened in 2023, but when this sort of reversal sinks in and when people can actually assess the damage and realize that this is now for long, do you think they may have more support for, you know, a more compromise or for a more peaceful transition out of this?
Yeah, majority of Finns have that. We have like, most of them who are still alive, we have relatives who fought the wars against Soviet Union or Russia. And we have like information on those. And we have memories of the times when, you know, the relationship was normal. So I think, yeah, generally you can just think that majority of Finns would be okay with the with the situation with Russia normalizing, and of course there would be some portion which would think against, but you know, there are always those people, but they are a clear minority here. So majority would support it.
Well, Professor Melanin, you know, we have this saying in Russian that a true nature of everything is learned in comparison, and I'm sure that the incredible case of Greenland will help the Europeans in general, but particularly the Scandinavians, to wake up to the harsh geopolitical reality that's around them. We'll get to analysis in a minute, but first of all, how do you think the ordinary people in Finland, in Sweden, in Denmark are taking this rather bare-knuckle push by Donald Trump? And is it changing anything in their view of politics and what's good and what's bad?
Well, it certainly does. And I think, or I hope, that the veil, so to speak, will now fall from the eyes of many that NATO or US is a reliable partner. So this is something good that could come out of this. But I think it's just time for, you know, Finns and also the people in the Nordics to wake up that we Nordic people only can really make ourselves secure. So I'm actually thinking more of the lines that we should have the old Kalmar Union or the Nordic Union back. That would be the only, you know, security currency we have. But for sure, however, in whatever way the Greenland saga ends, it will have a tremendous effect on the thinking of the Finns about safety in our corner of the Arctic, so to speak.
Now, let me ask you, how do you understand all of this? Because when Trump first floated this idea, it was received as a, you know, another political stunt, but he seems to be quite serious about that. And from what I've seen of the Davos discussions, the issue of Greenland absolutely dominates all the security discussion in Europe. Very few people remember that there is a kinetic war in Ukraine right now. Everybody's talking about Greenland. So how do you understand the American intentions here?
Once again, there's a threshold that has been surpassed in the thinking or analytics of Pentagon, which has led to this. But I think the bigger picture or the bigger problem in this case is that we are moving back to the age of power politics, which dominated the globe since the or before the Second World War. And there is probably a combination of the worry in Pentagon and also the aspirations of Donald Trump to become the, enshrine his name in the history books by making the biggest enlargement of the U.S. in the, you know, history of the country. So I think these two mix, but they create a very like a dangerous mix though. But and this is something as a son of a lecturer of history, I would not want this world to come back, but it's already here, basically.
Mm-hmm. A lot of European leaders are now talking about that welcoming of more American presence in the Arctic, and there's also an agreement between the United States and Denmark that actually allows for that. The United States, if it just wanted to project more military power into the Arctic, it didn't have to change the national affiliation of Greenland, and that led many people to speculate that what he's really after is the property rights and maritime boundaries when it comes, you know, those are important when you think about mining mineral resources. Now, do you think Denmark and Europe more generally are ready to part this with this enormous asset? Because I assume it's not only America and Donald Trump that need to get access to enormous energy resources, but Europe itself, if it looks into the future, it needs some energy to develop itself, does it not?
Yeah, it does. And I honestly don't have an answer to this, to that question, simply because we are at uncharted waters now. We haven't, quite literally. So we haven't had this situation in Europe for quite a long time. None of our leaders, you know, basically understand the situation, I think, in a political sense, what is going on. And so I don't know. I honestly do not know how they're going to play this. I'm still thinking that on the side of President Trump, that this is a play for a bigger role in the art, in Greenland, maybe. But it's starting to look very, very like he's actually preparing for an invasion of Greenland as the last measure. I cannot say where I have heard this, but I trust the source that preparations are ongoing. And that would be unprecedented. And it would probably kill the NATO, which I think I'm rather certain that President Putin would be very happy for. But it would, I don't know, Europe would be in very perilous situation. And the Nordics especially. We would come under threat from several, or we could see ourselves coming under threat from several fronts.
But Professor Malinin, maybe it's also an opportunity to actually look at the threats and make a mature conclusion about which threats are genuine and who are your friends and who are your foes, and, you know, draw some policy out of that rather than, be based in some fantasies that push you towards a war on one front and make you miss a real threat on another. So maybe that could be a true reality check for the European leaders.
Yeah, if they would act on the interest of the general European populace, I'm sure this would be the case. But I don't think they do. I don't know from who they are taking orders from, but it's not the general populace of Europe. So this makes... Because we have to assume that there is some kind of background force here. This makes the forecasting of future developments very difficult, because we don't know what the force is seeking for. So these are like what the questions you raise and the thinking you raise are very good. They're very good points. But the problem is that we don't know who the European leaders serve at the time.
But ultimately, I mean, that's the purpose and the nature of educated democratic class, to make sure that they actually have their representatives and that policies are being executed on their own behalf and in their own interest. I can't believe that Meet the Russian is telling a Finnish scholar that what democracy is supposed to be about. But this is indeed, you know, strange times that we live in, and I really appreciate your being with us today. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart next week.